Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Companion. I'm your host and rant specialist du jour, Dale Graham. Thanks for coming back to those of you who are following us. And to if you're new to this show, I hope you find it entertaining and thought-provoking a bit and interesting. To start off the show, I just want to, of course, this is the second day of February, the 33rd day of the year, 2014. Wherever you happen to be on the planet, I hope you're enjoying the day, making the most of it, out of it, because the day isn't going to make the most out of you. It's just not a passive, life isn't a passive event. You have to grab it by the coattails and get to it. Now listen to this, and I'll give you a little piece of what's on my mind today. And it's endearing. Check this out. I'll be right back.
Here comes the sun, nice.
Now, I'm not saying what's going to happen on Groundhog Day, but I'm hoping that the little buggers are tuning in. Not that I'm desperate for... Well, I love winter. Of course, I'm Canadian. You know, blah, 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 blah. Bring the sun. Bring the sun. My roots, our roots go back into... Today, we can all be pagan. We can worship the sun. It's up there somewhere, and if we don't do the right things, it's never going to come back. And, man, the crops will fail, and we're all going to hell in a handcart. So whatever we have to do to live the good life and please the Ra or Sol or whatever you want to call it, get to it. There's no time like the present. I thought that was kind of fitting today. And hope that sticks. A couple of hours, I guess, we're not going to see any shadows, and winter, summer's going to return, winter's going to end. Fantastic. This is the XLVIII Super Bowl. L being 50, X being to the left of it, it makes it 40, and the VII makes it 48, doesn't it? V5. And it's going off in 10 hours, 36 minutes, and 29 seconds, 28 seconds, 27 seconds. So get to it. Put the beer outside so it chills. And not that I'm a big fan of that sport anymore. I've gone off it. I turned into a... English Premier League fan, Scottish League Division II, go Montrose, Gable Endies. There's nothing like it. But I wish the boys well. This is a big cultural event around the world. I suppose billions and billions are going to sit there and watch it. What else is going on today? Oh, it's the Feast of Bridget, isn't it? Yeah. Did you get with the program here, boys? Another little tidbit I want you to work into your conversations today. This celebrates St. Bridget of Kildare. She was alive circa about 451. Now, you know, that's when she was born. She's also known as Bridget of Ireland. It was one of Ireland's patron saints, God bless them all, along with Patrick and Columba. Her name is variously spelled, but, you know, Bridget with a T, with a D, doesn't really matter. She's legendary, and she's one of an early Christian nun and founder of several monasteries for nuns, including one in Kildare, of course. And she's considered legendary, highly revered. So her feast day just passed. And around here, the Bacchanalia, I tell you, it was just exceptional, exceptional. On that day, it marks... And the pagan Irish year marks the beginning of spring, the lambing and lactation of cattle, you know, good things. And she's also considered by some to be the goddess of beer and speaks very highly of the a lake, yeah? As she said, a prayer attributed to Bridget, quote, I'd like a great lake of beer for the King of Kings. I would like to be watching heaven's family drinking from it through all eternity. Well, God bless you, little darling. There you go. And I'm sure the boys and girls, women masons that are tuning in are people with a bit of an inclination towards some of the Masonic principles, are embracing that idea right now. So I want you all to sit back in your favorite comfortable overstuffed chair and with your favorite glass of Kool-Aid tightly gripped in your hand and sit back and see what we can get into today. We're going to have a a little bit, I'm trying to create a bit more a balance in a old school Masonic way with my version, my interpretation of what music was able to do in the early days. And I can't take you back, or I would like to go back to 14th, 15th, 16th century, just in a little time capsule, so we're not subjected to all the nastiness that was going on then, and just to watch and learn and see what the experience was like. But I mean, we can't, so we have to approximate it. We can't experience what the idea of singing together in Lodge was like when it began. And we know that for a lot of us, it's stopped. If you're a member of the Royal Arch, you know that song is part of some of the ritual, but there's still a tremendous, I'm talking about the self-consciousness that goes on. And I'd like to think that it's like probably going into a church service in a way. You know, when you go and you haven't been there for a while, you feel that self-consciousness. And when you see somebody that's not used to being there, you can tell because it's like when you go to the hockey game and all the fellas can't just sing our national anthem because they're not used to they're distracted by the sound of their own voice. Well, boys, it's not about you. it's that self-consciousness. So, and you see it all the time. So I think in lodges it must have happened similarly. You know, why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it? Of course it would. And today you've got a grip on Groundhog Day, I hope. It's and if you're you want to make up for your lack of homage to St. Bridget, I would hope that you'll find your own Lake of the Brew today. What more fitting kind of a day? So this is a day, you know, we have Groundhog Day. If it's cloudy when a groundhog emerges, then spring will come early. If it's sunny, see its shadow, run back in. This is when we pull out the little badger, the little critter from its sleep, and you stick it up in the air. You know, gosh, a little Marmotamonax has to love that kind of attention. Can't you just imagine sitting there minding its own business, and then the rivalry between between Wyerton and Pennsylvania, you know, is legendary, and Puxatani. Of course, they get it a little bit later than us because they check what we're doing up here and then sort of cross-references make it seem like they get it right. This was, first documented, yeah? Groundhog Day, about February 4th, 1841, and it was in Morgantown, Pennsylvania. The last day, the last Tuesday, the second of Candlemas Day, the day in which, according to the Germans, the groundhog peeps out of its winter quarters and if it sees its shadow, it pops back in for another 6 weeks. But if the day is cloudy and he remains out, then the weather is to be moderate. And in Scotland, the poem, if Candlemas Day is bright and clear, there'll be two winters in the year. Yeah. And an English poem, if Candlemas be fair and bright, winter has another flight. If Candlemas brings cloud and rain, winter will not come again. So in the Western countries of the Western Northern Hemisphere, the official first day of spring is almost 7 weeks or 46, 48 days after Groundhog Day. It's on March 20th or 21st. So, you know, that custom could have been an old folk embodiment, a bit of a confusion created by the collision of two calendrical systems. I like that, calendrical systems. It makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about. But some of the old traditions mark the change of seasons at cross-quarter days, such as in bulk, which when daylight first makes a significant progress across the night. And other traditions held that spring did not begin until the length of daylight overtook night. Like we noted that as the vernal equinox. And that's coming up. So I hope you're going to be notably excited. And if nothing else, the old hedgehog was incorporated as a yearly custom to settle the two traditions. It's like, hey, we can't decide. Let the hedgehog decide, and then we'll all go with it, and maybe we'll tip a pint together, and yeah, there you go. How do you get over that? If a lot of the wrinkled-faced wars and battles were settled like that, I think the world would be a better place. But we have to go and do stupid things to each other in the meantime. So we call Groundhog Day stupid? My, there's no. Check your dictionary and you're going to see the cause of some of the major battles through history. And that will help you really get a good grip on what stupid is. I'm not saying that people are stupid. I'm just saying that we pad our idiots in the 21st century in a way that has never been seen before, and we're calling ourselves progressive. I don't think so. So this is, I thought this was kind of an interesting topic focus to have today, and pursuing the good life without light or with. Because, you know, we're allegedly fooling around with we subscribe to some of these notions, but we become very much a target of a lot of mockery for embracing a way of thinking that is not exactly what you call headline news being who we are and what we are. We're a group that's easily dismissed. We should be. We don't have any valence over the rest of the world. Everybody has their own issues and their way of thinking. I don't think we cling to these principles and philosophies. I think we need them. There's an appetite for it, but it's answering a question that's a little deeper. If that is the need to socialize and be accepted, I don't think that's a bad thing. The alternative is loneliness and despair and confusion. If that's the alternative, then welcome aboard. But there comes a time when some of the philosophies begin to permeate, don't they? And you do this on your own. Nobody can compel you. All the gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands about what should go on is a little bit misguided, I think. The world should be a better place. It shouldn't rain. It shouldn't rain except when my crops need a perfect drenching, and the temperature should always be ambient for me, cool and crisp when I want a nice walk in the woods, and frosty when I need to hear the squeak of the snow underneath my feet, and I should be the center of the bloody universe, but I'm waiting in line. There happens to be, about 7.5 billion of you ahead of me. So if you're thinking that you're not liking what you see, get in line. We absolutely respect your opinion. We're going to get around to you, but you're at the end of the line. And everyone in front of you has an equally vigorous point of view about what needs to be there. And so if we're going to get all preachy about it, stop that. Never worked, never will. It is what it is. Freemasonry is isolating. When you start to get into your own head, and you start to realize that growth and change happens inside. You want to brag about it, people may tolerate you, but that's all they're doing. That's what you need. Then you're in for a mighty interesting lesson as you get older, because that lesson is taught to all of us. You know, you have to be pretty thick-headed not to figure out your mistakes and errors I'm never claiming that Freemasonry is a 12-step program. Freemasonry is a one-step program. You step into the abyss based on faith, huh? Trust. Now, only a fool would trust, huh? Need proof. You need evidence. There's enemies and suspicion behind every corner. Every unexpected knock on the door is a cause of alarm. Good God. Like I said, we pad the idiocy. You know? God, sir. Hey, for those of you in Ottawa, hi. Don't hurt yourself too much. It's Winterlude up there. I know that you're going to be chewing on a beaver tail and skating your little heart's delight up and down the Rideau, the canal. Beautiful. I hope it's sunny there today for you. As it should be. It's like it's you know, it's transcendent when it's the sun comes out and you're up there. So this show tends to bring out the poet in me, I think. Poetry, I'll tell you, here's a little piece on what poetry is. I scratch my head, I never have a clue what this stuff means. I went to T.S. Eliot and he said, poetry is not a turning loose of emotion. Like I thought, you know, this is what it is. It's trying to capture the unexpressed emotion. He said, no, it's not. But an escape from emotion. It is not the expression of personality, but an escape from personality. But of course, only those who have personality and emotions know what it means to want to escape from these things. Just when you think you've got it figured out, he just hooks you in, didn't he? Plato said, poetry is nearer to vital truth than history. So for all of the fact finders out there, living the better life because they are embracing the so-called hard sciences. I'm thinking back to a point where there were no divisions. Science was what it was. Who is to say amongst us that the poets don't find answers to the major problems going on? And if they do, and if we're not paying attention, who's the fool? Hard science, soft science? I don't think so. Genuine poetry can communicate before it is understood. So when you go away, you know, think about it. Freemasonry is like that. You'll experience it. You can communicate it, but it's not. It's in a way. Yes, I'm saying that it's poetry, because it's communicated before it's understood. Do you think? Yeah. Let's presume we're all smart. This is my little preamble. You mind if I get into this? We take life seriously. Exposure to history and philosophy, the arts and classical literature are deliberately planned during our childhood. All people are to be treated fairly. We expect to live a good life under government accountable to us. Our soldiers are well equipped, heavily trained, and make us prepared to defend our way of life. Utopia. With all the uncertainties of life, we are constantly surprised by changes happening around us. Orators define some of us as liberal or conservative or secular. We experience outbreaks of tribal violence. The good life includes a fountain of youth and youthful exuberance view until the grave. We have appliances that demystify but bring an undertone that some unknown source is always better. Raise your child, you haven't got a clue. Go to a do-it-yourself manual. Go to some self-help. Go to somebody that studied psychology. And they'll tell you and me how to raise a child. Except it ain't working, is it? So you want to pipe in Mozart to the fetal cavity? Go ahead. If that's what makes you happy, go right ahead. If you want to exercise your brain as a defense against disease, go ahead. The science doesn't tell. The boring science doesn't tell us whether playing a game of gin or cribbage with your best friend is any more effective than doing physics or learning a second or third language. Oh, yes. Okay. Sorry. Nobody wants to pay attention to brain anatomy and brain chemistry, do they? No, it's boring. And it's complicated as heck to try and understand it. Anyway, we experience a lot. But, so we have this, we're in this atmosphere where we remember the period of humanism wasn't always present. The reverence for the individual. And now we seem to be saying intellectually the individual isn't smart enough as its smart is its smartphone. You were function without a smartphone. What in the world has happened to you? So we can spout facts read off a page, but that doesn't mean we understand them. The way we connect with each other has changed, of course. privacy has become a commodity. Sadly. It is daunting to think how much universality will be needed by a world that does not know what a Freemason knows. Anachronistic but relevant, fraternal yet universal, historical yet contemporary, we continue asking the unanswered questions. Life, we know our entrance and departure are as singular as conscience, as courage and belief. How do you understand conscience except in your own mind? You and I can talk about what we think it is, but the understanding is in my mind and in your mind and in the next fellow's mind. The craft masonry, the atmosphere of the lodge, and preservation of the landmarks are unchanged, though some might want to persuade us otherwise. Freemasonry provides a rich palette of ideas if one is a seeker. It's in Ontario, it's more often pastiche of church basements. Very, very few symbols. Hardly, my goodness, hardly anything esoteric. There's a reason for that, of course. It's like we look at Freemasonry with one eye, and that eye is squinting. It's okay to beautify our lodges. Yeah, it is. It's okay to add color, add depth and dimension. Yeah, it absolutely. I swear, cross my heart, would never steer you wrong. It's okay. Oh, hasn't been done? Liar, liar, pants on fire. Yeah, it has been done. Is being done. Was done. If you need to see the potential, you want to just see what talent and art and fusion with masonry is, drag you and a bunch of your best friends over to Detroit. Make an appointment to go to the Grand Lodge building in Detroit and be prepared. It is altering. It is altering. Freemasonry provides a rich palette if one is a seeker. If you seek, you will find. But if you're not, it's not saying you're not motivated. It's saying you're not a seeker. Period. Freemasonry was never intended to be absolute or clear. This brought to mind some of the work in the history of the Delphi. Her answers, you know, people would just clamor. You know, they had to start to get bureaucracy in place to control it. Same as Freemasonry. You had to have some structure and organization to control the clamor. People were coming in droves from many countries to put their questions to the Delphi, to the Oracle. Her answers were obscure, to say the least. That's what made me think, made me realize. Our Freemasonry is not absolute. It's not a yes, no, follow this path and this is what you'll get. It tests commitment. Does it test commitment? Yeah. It tests virtue and authenticity. But natural justice renders the result inevitable, stark and irrefutable. Failure, such an interesting perspective, that one. How do you fail at life? You are, we are, I am what I am. Potential is another matter, eh? Make it happen. All this in a gentle atmosphere of learning. Is that utopia? Now, tell me, is it just pie in the sky thinking? Is it being childish and ridiculous to think that one day the lodges could realize that you needed an atmosphere, that you can produce an atmosphere that is conducive to learning, to thoughtful conversation, and to camaraderie? No, I'm not suggesting, yes, I am, that the atmosphere of a pub is probably more conducive than the atmosphere of a lot of Masonic lodges I've been in. But I'm just saying, when I'm in a room that's just boring, it's like I can, you know, that's cellular to me. I want a room that is warm and engaging and has personality, has character, that brings out conversation and brings out the overstatement so we can examine it. the limits of reason. Can that be done in other places? Oh my goodness, yes. Yes, you can find that on a park bench with two fellows that are out for a walk, where particularly where the park bench is placed by somebody with a bit of a sense of the aesthetic, where there's a vista or a view or a perspective that just is very relaxing. In the little town that I'm in, you don't find that so much. It's still quite an industrial, utilitarian kind of approach to the world. But the aesthetic is coming forward. There's artists and painters just pouring into the place. And sooner or later, it's beginning, you know, we have little bookshops downtown that are just intriguing. And there's always the delightfully artistic community hanging around. And writers, then you can go and buy their book and you can see them sipping their latte. If you want to watch a writer sip a latte, go ahead. But there's so many people. We have masons that are pick up a brush and are expressing themselves in words and ideas in color on canvas and on board and paper. It happens, in spite of ourselves, that we move toward an aesthetic environment. It's happening. It will happen in everybody's life. And I think we need to be able to talk about it. You wonder it's not what's missing. It's how do you enhance? How do you create? So you and your boys, and we think on a microscopic level. What works in one area does not work in all areas. So work with your boys. Work with your crew about creating that atmosphere. You know, create the atmosphere that works. And I think that part of that is geography and history. You know, if I think about the atmospheres for these kind of conversations in my experience on Prince Edward Island, sometimes it was with a tool in my hand, or sometimes it was at the end of a long day of work on the farm. Memories, eh? The discussions where you find that, you know, somebody is saying something, working it into the conversation, where people are receptive to somebody being thoughtful. I think it's not always that way. Thoughtful people can easily be dismissed. I think there is a risk if we get into, for those fellows who have started to get into the occult and esoteric side of Freemasonry, I think they realize the risk. The things that they're exploring and reading and thinking about and not able to talk about freely. Risk, eh? And we identify it, yeah. It's not unheard of. And I guess it's quite commonplace, wouldn't you say? How could you have a life without that? So so we move on. Eh? Life is it's not bad. It's not bad. So I'm going to
Hey Jude.
No, we don't want Hey Jude. Let's move on to get back into what we were talking about the other day, eh? I wanted to continue from the Art and Architecture of Freemasonry by James Stevens Curl, and we'll pick that up from last week. But I've been teasing you with this material written by Margaret C. Jacob. And remember, we tried a couple of years ago to arrange for Professor Jacob to come to be a keynote speaker in St. Catharines at the Sankey lecture. And her schedule wouldn't allow it. She was very graceful, but she was already doing a lecture in Alberta. I can't imagine that she has all kinds of opportunity on the west coast of North America. Why would you ever want to fly across the continent unless you like New York or Montreal or Toronto? I mean, the place is not a hick town. The place is, we're in a gorgeous part of the world. Anyway, she's busy over there. You can imagine. California would keep her, where she works at the university, would keep her enormously busy. But a couple of years ago, I happened to find this book, quite unbeknown. Margaret C. Jacob was completely unknown to me. It was called "The Living the Enlightenment, Freemasonry and Politics in 18th Century Europe." And I think I got this if I'm not mistaken, I may have got this at a university bookstore. I think. And I seem to be able to remember which store I was in. Anyway, I wanted to Living the Enlightenment. So that caught my eye. Let me read to you a little bit about creating the chapter on creating constitutional societies. And I suggest if you're interested in adding a really curious dimension to your understanding of Freemasonry, this is a thoughtful, well-researched book. You get lots of notes and the references in it, enough to make anybody quite satisfied, I'm sure. Get this. It's 224 pages of just very, very interesting. Here, give you a little example here before you start to read on the constitutional societies. Rather than imagining the Enlightenment as represented by the politics of Voltaire or Gibbon or even Rousseau, or worse, as being incapable of politics, we might just as fruitfully look to the lodges for a nascent political modernity. In them, discourses both civic and enlightened merged, and old words like fraternity and equality took on new meanings, with which in 1789 the whole of the West became suddenly familiar. Perhaps we can now better understand why opponents of the French Revolution thought they knew which of their enemies among their many enlightened foes was most obviously to blame for what had happened. In the final analysis, Freemasonry, for all its exclusivity, secrecy, and gender bias, transmitted and textured the Enlightenment, translated all the cultural vocabularies of its members into a shared and common experience that was civil and hence political. Sit back. Oh, have you noticed your glass? The darnest thing about a good glass of Kool-Aid is the evaporation problem. I apologize to all of you for suggesting. But, you know, as you're sitting here, it might be a time to top up. And if you're daft enough to have not brought your backup jug of Kool-Aid to sit with you beside you, well, it's next time. The early years of the Masonic fraternity on the continent were plagued by disputes engendered largely by ecclesiastical authorities, both Protestant, as was the case in Nijmegen, and Catholic. Can you imagine? We'd be a threat. Early days. But controversy was never solely the work of anti-Masonic publicists external to the lodges. The task of establishing these new constitutionally governed societies also brought with it a crisis over legitimacy and authority, and not least over national identity, as the fraternity spread far and away from the London Grand Lodge. Now remember, I tend to think of myself as a conservative Mason. And I think the more I study, the more I respect appreciate the strength, the firmness of our Grand Lodge. And if I scratch the surface, if you want to seek the meaning of that, it's to protect us. And there's the reasons where that started. We are like babes in the woods without the protection of our Grand Lodge. Not because we become simple-minded, but because we have, there's a lot of groups around us that would like to see us disappear. And so we can't, you and I know that what we're doing is sensitive and private. We're not proselytizing. So we have to be careful. When I hear my good friend, let's talk to my good friend Ken, who wants to, you know, put a billboard up. Well, we have to be careful. The minaret or the cross or the, you know, the billboards of faith-based of religions. We have to be careful about this slippery slope. Huh? The task of establishing these new constitutionally governed societies also brought with it crisis over legitimacy and authority. The records of Dutch Freemasonry once again richly illustrate this phenomenon. They permit us to watch the tensions and uncertainties of the fraternal participants in this new and unique form of social and political behavior. As one example, we shall focus on the disagreements that arose between the most historically important Dutch lodge located in Amsterdam and called after 1754, Le Bien Ami, my good friend, and the National Grand Lodge in The Hague. Woven into their disputes were issues about the nature of true Masonic government, and more precisely about the validity and legitimacy of the Masonic Constitution. Amid these disputes, we could also witness some of the first efforts made on the continent, if only in a private, voluntary setting, to exercise a form of self-government. This really is a reminder, Jacobs is reminding us, Freemasonry doesn't develop in isolation, there are connections. There's communication at a broad and global level. It continues on today. We like to know what the neighbors are doing and what they're thinking. And a lot we find, you know, the Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario is noteworthy. Our history is very interesting. The history of diplomacy, the history of a connection, a respect, a legitimacy. We don't hang our heads, nor should any Mason, of course. Our history is remarkable and revealing. Within the confines of private sociability, the abstractions found in some of the least favorite texts of the Enlightenment, from the favorite texts of Enlightenment, from Locke, I suggest you take a look at that. Google your brains out with that, L-O-C-K-E, and Montesquieu, and not least Voltaire, yes, Mason, yes, who praised all things English, may take on for us a more textured meaning. I guess you think about it, if you're thinking, if we all look in the mirror and admit, where and ask ourselves, where is civilization? Well, man, sit yourself down in the middle of London. Hard to deny. Just go there. Go there. Be there. Think about it. And find a nice pub that will fuel you with a bit of Kool-Aid. In this chapter and in subsequent ones, we look to the Enlightenment as it was lived in the new continental lodges. Hear, hear. The new lodges, both in Britain and on the continent, were never simply private fraternal societies. They were also, as in Dundee Lodge, constitutionally governed and legitimized civic societies. Predictably, within their private deliberations can also be found overtones of larger national and international issues about which brothers appear to have had deep disagreement. In the microscopic polity constituted by a lodge, values and issues drawn from the larger society were debated and negotiated. Social place and rank were adjudicated, and the nature of authority was questioned and resolved. In the Dutch lodges, events in the political experience of the Republic at mid-century played into, exacerbated, and possibly even at moments caused this atmosphere of internal controversy. The records of Le Bien Ami, as well as other Dutch lodges, permits us to reconstruct the fluidity between the private and the public, just as they also reveal the tensions between the desire for orderly Masonic government and the autonomy of individual lodges, between obedience to the national authority of the Grand Lodge and the rebellion against it. Two events in the history of the Dutch Republic provide the background. The revolution of 1747-48, which restored the Stolitdraad, and the so-called diplomatic revolution of 1756, which broke the historic alliance between the Republic and its British and Austrian allies. leading the Austrians into an alliance with France. In that same year, Dutch Freemasons established their independence from the Grand Lodge of London, creating a national Grand Lodge in The Hague. Similarly, so you see the connection that Jacobs is revealing to us. The growth in the heart rests on the foundation of the Grand Lodge of England. Yeah? The Dutch Revolution of 1747 not only was restorative, but it extended to radical protests against the corruption of the Republic. These protests were most pronounced and violent in Amsterdam in 1748. One of the leaders of the radical movement was Rousset de Missy, M-I-S-S-Y, the founder of Freemasonry in Amsterdam in 1735. He began his public political involvement in the revolution in 1747 as a publicist and official historian of the Orangist cause. And you remember William of Orange and, yeah, okay. All the historians of that, William and Mary, and, you know, how that went over so well with the Jacobites, yeah? Mm-hmm. Sonny, that's an interesting piece of history. William the Fourth, yeah. In this political role, Rousset most often followed directions from William Bentinck, a key advisor to William the Fourth, and himself, he was a Freemason. The Bentinck is Bentinck. In response to the confusion provoked by the French invasion of Zeeland, which in turn prompted the sudden restoration of the Staderot, Rousset, working in the service of Bentinck, briefly contemplated in 1748 bringing out a new edition of the French text of John Locke's Two Treatises of Government. Presumably, the edition was meant to justify the revolution as it was. As was believed, Locke's text had justified the revolution of 1688 over half a century earlier in England. You remember, that was after the Civil Wars, wasn't it, that led up to Charles I being beheaded in 1649. And then what, 30 years later, that his son, Charles II, was reinstated to the monarchy and the experiments with the Roundheads and the experiments with Cromwell's new army. But in 1748, the project came to nothing. Locke's ideas on government may have been put to other uses by Rousset and his Masonic brothers when in 1755 they attempted to reconstitute and revitalize their lodge. In that same year, Rousset and his publisher and Masonic brother Johann Schröder finally brought out the new, slightly altered edition of the French version of the Two Treatises. The one project fed into the other. Rousset's dedication to an idealized version of English constitutional government found expression both in his work as a journalist, translator, and editor, and in his leadership of the Lodge. I'm going to tell you about Le Bien Ami in 1755, the little lodge. Yeah? I wanted to lead up to that a little bit, just because we're already hitting the sort of the highlights of I don't want to get stuck in the weeds about the development of the history of Freemasonry in Holland. That's not the point here. But I also don't want to be dismissive. You have the idea that there was a challenge, an ecclesiastical challenge in the 18th century. And what would we do after we've gone to the work of, you know, developing these ideas that had already been established from as far back as we know, 15th century, hundreds of years, and the church at the time was a little bit different than it is today, similar but different, was challenging notion of these private organizations. This was uh, This was antagonistic. This was adversarial. And it was a fight, a battle for the minds of people. You know, remember, certain religions want their followers to think a particular way. And here, I guess not too starry-eyed, is the notion that we come along and say that really isn't important. That's your private matter. What you believe, you hold dear to your heart. And that's something that allows us all to share a common purpose, yeah? Yeah, of course it does. So in response to the confusion provoked by there was confusion at the time. Well, you can see that Freemasonry went to ground. In the mid-18th century, the linking of these causes to political agitation, petition, riot, and open defiance was strikingly new in continental Europe. Predictably, the authorities were alarmed and moved quickly to exploit differences among the radicals, as well as to liberalize access to office holding, particularly in Amsterdam. The significance here is these were major, very sophisticated cultures, the product of their ability to conduct trade and their willingness. The markets these were people that were explorers, that were funding marketeers, private people who had gained rank because of their success in the marketplace. And they were able to fund private initiatives. And new is better. If you could find new sources, you could get in there and get the best price, undermine your competition, and you grew, and you grow. But in 1755, Rousset's Lodge saw itself as persecuted by the larger society, quote, by a slanderous public, evil-minded hypocrites, prejudiced writers, frightened rulers, cursed Inquisition, thundering Vaticans, and booming preachers. Ouch. In the history of our days, as Johann Schroeder lectured to his brothers on the annual feast day in late 1755, could be added the, quote, blackened reputations of the Vatican and the Inquisition, the names of the cities of Amsterdam and Nijmegen. In the past few years since its closing, he continued, the lodge has been like a hunted bird. Our only joy comes from the contemplation of ourselves. Only recently, the brothers have been like sheep without a shepherd. But now, after receiving proper and legal authority, he quickly reopened the lodge as legal members of a legal lodge. Schroeder's obsessive concern is to assert the legal, quote, to use his own words, existence of his reconstituted lodge, and to affirm its legality by pointing to the growth in membership, and more important, to the fact that other lodges recognize it. Indeed, even Freemasons from other countries visit the lodge and sign its visitor's book. Legality and hence legitimization, he asserts, are provided by the representatives of other lodges. And these, in turn, receive a legal reception from Le Bien Ami. The law that Schroeder refers to here has nothing to do with the laws of the country. These are laws and legality being created in the private realm by men for other men by the lodges themselves. You would think that if we were able to explain that you can authenticate your being, your sense of individuality through Freemasonry, then people may step forward. I think this is one of their, personally, this is one, in my humble opinion, subsequent to the advice and the expertise of all of you, of course, that this is one of the things in the back of the minds of people that come to our door. When they walk through, we never hear, sorry, but we never hear this part of history. The men who lead our lodges were uninformed. And come on now, let's be fair. This type of material wasn't exactly accessible. Unless we were crawling around Le Bien Ami, how many Masons would have realized and known this kind of a connection? Now think about it. This is legitimizing the lodge. is saying that a Masonic lodge is legitimate in the civic context. When we're being hammered, when we're being assailed by politicians and that quasi-religious political estate, we want to establish that we do exist. That doesn't mean the opposition is going to go away. It doesn't. But it does establish that we are moving forward from a base of legitimacy, legal legitimacy, as Jacobs is saying, that we were creating for ourselves. So Masonic law was taken most seriously by the brothers. In 1756, when the reconstituted lodge was quarreling with the Grand Lodge in the Hague over allegiance to it, what was at stake between them were what they described as legitimization and sovereignty, the rule of laws and the nature of duly constituted authority. We add that to the mixture, the reports that come out of Grand Lodge every year, and we see the importance that our Grand Lodge must prevail, that our laws are fundamental to reinforcing the legitimization and ongoing sovereignty of ancient and accepted Freemasonry. We can't dismiss that. We can't let that be taken for granted. And so the commitment to all of this and recognition of the importance of this is renewed each year at our annual communication. Yeah. By the 1760s, the Grand Lodge would extend its legal prerogatives nationally and assume the power to adjudicate between plaintiffs and defendants, even awarding damages to the defendant when he was absolved of the accusations against his person. In 1755, the minutes of Le Bien-Aimé's meeting bear out the relevance of Schroeder's oration about legitimacy. In late 1754, members of the disbanded lodge met, consulted, and deliberated with each other and decided to request that the very vulnerable master, Brother Roussette de Missy, out of his power and authority by an authentic document, would grant and authorize them to form a regular lodge, and would for his part appoint a brother in his name and for his part to reopen the closed lodge, to form the brothers into a legal lodge and in person to act as their venerable and master. Accordingly, Schroeder wrote to Roussette, still exiled in a small town outside Utrecht, and asked his permission to reopen the lodge. He responded with a true joy, quote unquote. We approve thus the proposition that he, Schroeder, has made for your part, and we consent very willingly to the request of our honorable brothers. Roussette then asked a brother by the name of Pierre Bunel as the master of the lodge, at the same time urging his brothers not to permit, quote, the pernicious innovations which false brothers seek to introduce. There were charlatans, there was fraud going on. Dale could come up with a degree and sell it to you, try and convince you if I was persuasive. Con artists, all showing complete disrespect for the need for continuity and familiarity of discussion and purpose and experience between lodges, just there to exploit, to make either to gain some authority, some sense of power for themselves at our expense. But he begged them to attach to the English constitutions. We recommend you to its paternal care, the protection. Roussette railed in particular against what he called galanterie, which he equated with French excesses. In the rules adopted by the lodge in 1756, the term appears along with religion and politics as specifically forbidden to be discussed. Galanterie, any excesses. In the years these discussions were taking place, the term could mean sexual license. It could also imply frivolity, the lack of serious purpose. In this Masonic context, Rousset juxtaposed gallantry as the antithesis of a modest or virtuous lifestyle. Again, just a little bit, eh? Just a little taste of a very rich pudding. Let me see, can I finish? I'll leave it there. We'll come back to this next week, and we'll talk about the legitimacy of the reconstituted lodge and what it rested on. Okay? You okay with that? I hope so. Fascinating when we take for granted these authorities and these sort of anachronistic, what can come across as quite anachronistic and stoic members of our form of Grand Lodge, and not realize the history behind the actions that they take and the exercise of their authority. Boy, I'm having fun here with that, aren't I? Not going to happen. Sorry, not going to happen. Not on my watch. So we have a different way of thinking about our Grand Lodge today. And I, not to be unfair, but I think it's a process. We are coming to grips with our own history, and it is new. We have to recognize that it's not going to be for us. It's not something that we can take for granted that we understand. But when we are puzzled, the answer is available to us in our history. You know, it's there. So I'll try and help us stumble along with this, if you don't mind. And man, do you need a refresher? Everybody okay? Do you need to fill up, top up there? To have great poets, says Walt Whitman, there must be great audiences. Yeah? You don't get it. You don't get art. You don't get science. You don't get the classics. You don't get classical literature. You don't get classical. It's like my old friend Cal said to me when I was talking about, he's just an enormously talented man, anything that he turns his hands to, he's one of those polyglots. When we were little boys, I used to love to walk through the woods with him. Even then, he would be able to bend down and show me these rare plants and name them. And he could name all of the trees in the forest. And now, when we still go out some 60 years later, I'm just so comfortable. He now can tell me about the rock formations and the development of the glacial process and the lakes, and can tell me about the weather. And he assigns such a natural way of teaching. I asked him. I was talking about needing to do something, some woodwork, and how discouraging it had been that I really didn't have his talent. And he stopped me. And this is what I'd say to you: if you've not, he said, all you have to do is be patient. And he said, I notice when you do something, Dale, you become impatient with yourself. And I thought, my goodness, it's true. When you're with somebody a long time like that. He notices things, and he did. And so I realized that I could make a cut. I could put things together. I have a sense of color and design. But now I approach it with, I put on some comfortable music, not something aggressive. I'm not a big fan of that, except when I'm driving in the car and I can turn it up, but sometimes. But when I can approach my work thoughtfully. And I owe him. From the experience of the blacksmith's son and farmer's son and the nephew of fisherman, I share this with you. An appreciation of what the classics can do doesn't come easily. It doesn't pour out. You have to want it. You have to be curious, and that means being curious to find out. So I always had the idea to find out what is the big deal, what it was, and what was the big deal about higher education? What was the big deal about the arts? What was the big deal about opera and the ballet and symphony music? What's the big deal? What's the big deal about Cajun music? What's the big deal about the blues? What's the big deal about jazz? And by doing that, I find that somebody asked me one day, many, many years ago, when I was teaching a class over in Windsor, what kind of music do you like? And I said, good music. And they thought I was, of course, being a bit above my station in life, but if the music, if it's country and it's good, if it's bluegrass and it's good, my foot's tapping. But I didn't want to feel, I realized that I've been taught, the history taught me, that I now have access to privilege that used to be only the heard by monarchs. So I can go and listen to a Puccini's opera. I can listen to Mendelssohn's work. I can that was commissioned by kings. So I can do that. But you can't make me. But I was curious about what's the big deal. And after a while, you find it out. You read, you ask questions, you absorb the atmosphere. What's the energy? Well, you find that there's this... Some work, some writers can capture an emotion and bring that out in an audience of hundreds of people every single time for well over 100 years. That's the big deal, if you get it. That's the big deal. The power. Now, do you want to taste that dish just to see the power? Somebody inside the head, getting into our heads and extracting an emotion, a response, and using words and musical narration to do it. I won't tell you where I've experienced that kind of power. But because I'm talking here about the appreciation of the classics, I just find so many people seem smug about that. Well, we just hate it because, you know. Well, it's like, have you tried it? And yeah, I come from that school. If you haven't tried it, you're missing something. It's not like I won't say if you haven't tried it, you don't have any right to a comment. I just think that's narrow-minded. That's being, I say, if you haven't tried it, you're probably missing something. Try it, and if you like it or not, what's the experience been like? Again, if you try these things, be thoughtful about them. Yeah. So that's my issue about the classics. This is why I think Freemasonry always surfs along the top of that. But, you know, at the risk of you don't want to alienate anybody, because a lot of times when you bring up these kind of topics, nobody has a chance to sit down and have discussion and say, well, this is why it's important. This is why we talk about the arts. I mean, you want to listen to a little Mozart. Is it because he's a Mason? No, it's the music is delightful. It's gorgeous. It gives a... Or do you read Shakespeare? What's that do to you? Man, it changes your vocabulary. Why is Shakespeare translated into... I don't think it's 7,000 languages. That's what's going on around the world right now. Why is it translated by all the major languages and being taught in China and India and France and Spain, and changes the vocabulary. It allows us to describe things in a way that other languages don't allow. Yeah, other languages have their place, but English language, just, there's a, I'll call it sublime. So if you haven't tried it, there's even ways to do it so you don't jump in off the deep end with something that's just too heady to try and follow. It's like if you're sitting down with scotch. Am I going to hand you a full peated a glass? No. I wouldn't do that. No. You want to taste something that, as we laughingly say, you know, the label says it has hints of heather and honey. I think when you get to the bottom of a bottle, you can come up with that kind of a language. Try it. Try little bits, a little tincture. Water it, taste. And you develop taste. You develop taste, or you can. Just like if I can develop a skill in painting, I do watercolor because I'm patient, and I have a wonderful instructor, my old friend Bill, who is the most incredible artist. If I can do it, I think it authenticates the process. I'm not saying everybody can, but it stimulates the curiosity. So do you do one thing forever? Well, no. I don't. I try things, and it's always that exploration. Can I do that? Well, if you're thoughtful about it, you put your mind to it, you're persistent. Yeah. Yeah. If you're rash and impatient, impetuous, nah. Nah. We are sunk, interestingly enough, into the Renaissance period and Freemasonry, aren't we? Yeah. And we're talking now about Neoplatonism. Here's the challenge for you. I'd like you to work that one into your conversations, you know, around your coffee clutch. And do it smoothly. Do it with some dignity and, you know, act like, you know, wrinkle your foreheads, you act like you know what you're talking about. It's a curious idea. Sure, I'll share it with you. Okay, this is the philosophical and religious system composed mainly of a mix of Platonic ideas and Egyptian and Asiatic mysticism, and it originated in Alexandria in the 3rd century. It's called Neoplatonism, and is perhaps best represented in the works of Plotinus and Porphyry. And Proclus permeated much of Renaissance thought and blurred distinctions between matter and spirit. Woo, woo. It was, of course, fundamentally pantheistic. The whole of the cosmos was seen as an entity. You okay to talk about this? Go from talking about the classics, getting a little too enriched, a little pinky finger starting to stick out on your glass when you're tipping your glass of Kool-Aid. That even made my old dog Minnie open an eye and look up at me here. We're a funny bunch, aren't we? Yeah. The whole of the cosmos was seen as an entity, and special attributes were accorded to symbols, numbers, colors, and letters. Oh, and I've got an interesting little piece from the Cabal. I must get around to that. That was fascinating. It has to do with Hiram Abiff and the number 273. Well, anyway, we'll come back to that. Good stuff, this. You know, just brilliant stuff in Freemasonry. The whole of the cosmos is seen as an entity. That's the everything merged with the divine. And the stars in the firmament were seen to be joined to man's fortune. Indeed, a harnessing of forces for the benefit of mankind was the aim of the occultists, alchemists, astrologers, and musicians. Note to self, tarot. We have got to get into tarot. Right? Who were associated with the remarkable rediscovery of Neoplatonic thought that had been obscured after the death of Julian the Apostate, who was devoted to Isis, most universal of deities. The search for esoteric knowledge through alchemy became a European obsession in the 16th and 17th centuries, before the Newtonian physicists put paid to such notions. In this connection, the materialistic ideas born of rationalism have been unfair to the age of alchemists. Rational, you know, fact. the positivism of the 20th century. For the 19th century, for the seeking of the philosopher's stone was more a striving for some form of moral and spiritual rebirth than a cheap way of making money in the literal sense. The alchemist desired to find a reality beyond the behind the physical world, and strove to understand and control forces of nature to give mankind powers beyond his imagining. The Renaissance alchemist sought a perfection of the spirit, a union with the divine in the universe, and a godlike presence of pure and revealed knowledge. Poetry of the period is frequently ecstatic and deeply concerned with the attainment of some unspoiled and spiritual plane of blinding clarity, unknown in experience. Thomas Traherne, for example, in his Centuries of Meditation, speaks of never enjoying the world aright. A little bit of poetry here. Till the sea itself floweth in your veins. Till you are clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars and perceive yourself to be the sole heir of the whole world. And more than so, because men are in it who are every one sole heirs as well as you. There is an ecstatic quality in his description of the corn as immortal wheat that should never be reaped, nor was ever sown, and in his thought that it had stood from everlasting to everlasting. Remember corn, like that little juxtaposition that we often forget? Think of peppercorn. We can take it literally and say, oh, corn plant. Just top up his beverage. That boy needs it. No, it's not a corn plant. It's corn wheat. Immortal wheat. Such notions are foreign to the more prosaic world of modern physics, born of Newtonian discoveries and in an age obsessed by measurement, ignoring the immeasurable as though it did not exist because it cannot be measured. But they are not foreign to the sensibilities of the Greco-Roman world. Needless to say, aspects of Neoplatonic occult ideas were formulated in secrecy, not only because of possible dangers from orthodoxy or powerful individuals or groups, but because if understanding of the hidden meanings of the universe were to be achieved, that knowledge could not be made public in order to prevent misuse. For only the pure and initiates were worthy vessels of such power. I'll read that again. That knowledge could not be made public in order to prevent misuse, for only the pure and initiates were worthy vessels of such power. Thus, secret societies existed and were associated with the search for knowledge and the guardianship of spiritual truths too precious to be bandied about. Masonic secrecy was thus nothing unusual, for it grew from the need for the craft to preserve the mysteries and signs of the trade, and developed at a time when exclusive and significant knowledge was treasured. Sharing with all would not only devalue the knowledge, but could be dangerous if the secrets or knowledge fell into the wrong hands. Emblems, symbols, and hieroglyphs were valued by thinkers of the Neoplatonic molds, for they were like perceived truths of the universe. They had meanings that could be interpreted, but they also disguised those meanings in decent obscurity from the uninitiated. The sages of the time believed that the eternal truths of divine revelation had been known in antiquity, notably by the ancient Egyptians, whose hieroglyphs offered intellects an endless source of contemplation and puzzlement. All the more so as many accessible hieroglyphs at the time were Roman or Italian works in the Egyptian taste and were of the bogus or decorative kind. Many attempts were made to decipher hieroglyphs, of which the most interesting were those of the Jesuit priest Anastasius Kircher. Although all barking up the wrong trees, they are at least show some reasoned attempt to codify Egyptian monuments and artifacts based on those in Rome itself. the importance of Egyptian religion in the Roman Empire, the elevation of Roman emperors as deities in conformity with Egyptian custom, and the fashion for Egyptian artifacts led to a very large collection of Egyptian and Egyptianized objects in Rome. Egyptianized. Interpretation of hieroglyphs was based on the belief that sacred and eternal truths had been concealed therein, and that their meaning was inadequately expressed in mere words. This notion was derived from a consideration of obscure passages. Obscure passages in scripture and in other writings. For the more obscure, the more minds strove to interpret the meaning. From the awe felt for hieroglyphs grew the evolution of the emblem and symbols as means of expressing ideas, truths, and meanings which had to be concealed from the ignorant and profane, but which could be read by the pure and initiated. It is hardly surprising that the literature on emblems of the period is enormous. Emblems consist of a picture incorporating symbols, hieroglyphs, and a composition with figures, designs, and the like, and had to have text explaining the meaning. Emblems codified certain ideas by convention, such as Masonic ritual used a pictorial set of emblems and a verbal catechism to suggest its truths. The invention and translation of emblems became a major part of late Renaissance teachings for truth and revelation, and involved layers of meaning with different aspects of truth, so much so that the truth was often made even more elusive. Obfuscation came and became an end in itself, and the unraveling of onion-like layers developed as a desirable goal. The obscure and the secret were seen as virtues, for had not the Creator concealed the secrets of the very universe? Thus, much literature of the period is many-layered, as though to secret important truths in obscurantist texts. Yeah, of course. And even the tools of the mason's craft were valued beyond what they were in actuality, and were given additional symbolic significances. The mason in his lodge, considering the meaning of the square, the triangle, and the compass, was imbued with the zeitgeist of Neoplatonist ideas and shared much of his outlook with the alchemist, the astrologer, and the seekers after the philosopher's stone. Ooh. Begins to bring it together? Yeah. A little bit. Just a taste. Don't want to spoil the appetite yet. What we're doing here is revealing a bit more about you, the seeker. Your alchemist's laboratory exposed to others who are seeking the knowledge. And so it goes. Here. Thank you. Interesting period. Interesting topics. The esoteric and the occult. Notions of Freemasonry. Inextricably woven with our history. Unbelievable. Carl Sandburg said, poetry is the opening and closing of a door, leaving those who look through to guess about what is seen during the moment. What can I say? One merit of poetry few persons will deny. It says more in fewer words than prose. It does. It's interesting. William Hazlitt. Interesting. Poetry is all that is worth remembering in life. Do you have a favorite poem that you can quote? If you don't, it's worth being able to quote passages and is an interesting, maybe that's something that people the likes of my age have still have in the back of their mind. I'm going to send you off now. You've been a great audience today. Thank you very much. I found it in my garage in a box of books. This is a work called Masonry Defined, a Liberal Masonic Education. Information Every Mason Should Have, and is compiled from the writings of Albert C. Mackay and many other eminent authorities, it says. And it's by E.R. Johnson, the originator of the questionnaire system of Masonic education. My copy was done at the National Masonic Press in Kingsport, Tennessee. This was copyrighted in 1930, so it's kind of interesting. It's all questions. It's the Socratic, isn't it? Ask a question. I'll just read. This is 224. Of what is the cornucopia emblematic? A source whence, according to ancient poets, every production of the earth was lavished. In the Masonic system, it is a symbol of joy, peace, and plenty. It is the official jewel of the steward. Yeah. By what three elements is a Mason proved? Air. Every human being at his birth becomes subject to the action of three elements. He comes out of water, passes through the air, and when he arrives at maturity, he is under the influence of fire. It is only at his death that he can participate in the fourth element, the earth. When he is initiated into the mysteries of Masonry, he is proved by the three elements of water, air, and fire. What is the sacred book of the Mohammedans called? The Al-Quran. The sacred book of the Mohammedans, or rather a sacred book, for they recognize the old Hebrew scriptures as of greater authority. The Al-Quran, commonly called the Quran, contains the revelations made to Muhammad, may peace be with him, his doctrines and precepts. In a Masonic lodge of Mohammedans, it should lie on the altar, as the Bible does in lodges of Christians. Has a woman ever been made a Mason? The Honorable Mrs. Aldworth. This lady received, about the year 1735, the first and second degrees of Freemasonry in Lodge number 44 at Donegal in Ireland. The circumstances connected with a singular initiation were first published in 1807 at Cork and subsequently republished by Spencer, the celebrated Masonic bibliophile in London. It may be observed, before proceeding to glean from this work the narrative of her initiation, that the authenticity of all the circumstances was confirmed on their first publication by an eyewitness to the transaction. The Honorable Elizabeth St. Leger was born about the year 1713 and was the youngest child and only daughter of the Right Honorable Arthur St. Leger, first Viscount Doneraile of Ireland, who died in 1727 and was succeeded by his eldest son, the brother of our heroine. Subsequent to her initiation into the mysteries of Freemasonry, she married Richard Aldsworth, Esquire of Newmarket in the County of Cork. Lodge number 44, in which she was initiated, was in some sort an aristocratic lodge, consisting principally of the gentry and most respectable and wealthy inhabitants of the country around Doneraile. The communications were usually sent in the town, but during the mastership of Lord Doneraile, under whom his sister was initiated, the meetings were often held at his lordship's residence. It was also one of these meetings at Doneraile House that this female initiation took place, the story of which Spencer, in the memoir to which we have referred, relates in the following words. It happened on this particular occasion that the lodge was held in a room separated from another, as it is often the case by stud and brickwork. The young lady, being giddy and thoughtless and determined to gratify her curiosity, made her arrangements accordingly, and with a pair of scissors, as she herself related to the mother of our informant, removed a portion of a brick from the wall and placed herself so as to command a full view of everything which occurred in the next room. So placed, she witnessed the first 2 degrees in masonry, which was the extent of the proceedings of the lodge on that evening. Becoming aware from what she heard that the brethren were about to separate, for the first time she felt tremblingly alive to the awkwardness and danger of her situation, and began to consider how she could retire without observation. She became nervous and agitated and nearly fainted, but so far recovered herself as to be fully aware of the necessity of withdrawing as quickly as possible. And in the act of doing so, being in the dark, she stumbled against and overthrew something, said to be a chair or some ornamental piece of furniture. The crash was loud, and the tiler, who was in the lobby or landing on which opened the doors, both to the lodge room and to that where the Honorable Miss Leger, St. Leger, was, gave the alarm, burst open the door, and with a light in one hand and a drawn sword in the other, appeared to the now terrified and fainting lady. He was soon joined by the members of the lodge present, and luckily, for it was asserted that but for the prompt appearance of her brother, Lord Doneraile, and other steady members, her life would have fallen a sacrifice to what was then esteemed her crime. The first care of her lordship was to resuscitate the unfortunate lady without alarming the house, and endeavor to learn from her an explanation of what had occurred. Having done so, many of the members being furious at the transaction, she was placed under guard of the tiler and a member in the room where she was found. The members reassembled and deliberated as to what, under the circumstances, was to be done, and over 2 long hours she could hear the angry discussion and her death deliberately proposed and seconded. At length, the good sense and irritated feelings of the rest of the members, when after much had been said and many things proposed, it was resolved to give her the option of submitting to the Masonic ordeal to the extent that she had witnessed the fellow craft. And if she refused, the brethren were again to consult. Being waited on to decide, Miss St. Leger, exhausted and terrified by the storminess of the debate, which she could not avoid partially hearing, and yet notwithstanding all, with a secret pleasure, gladly and unhesitatingly accepted the offer. She was accordingly initiated. Mrs., or as she was appropriately called, Sister Aldsworth, lived many years after, but does not seem ever to have forgotten the lessons of charity and fraternal love which she received on her unexpected initiation into the esoteric doctrines of the order. Placed as she was, said the memoir we have quoted, by her marriage with Mr. Aldsworth, at the head of a very large fortune, the poor in general had good reason to record her numerous and bountiful acts of kindness. Nor were these accompanied by ostentation. Far from it. It has been remarked of her that her custom was to seek out bashful misery and retiring poverty, and with a well-directed liberality soothe many a bleeding heart. Good Mason. Good Mason. I hope we can all live as well and say and be remembered in posterity for such acts as our means allows. And don't think that it's not a task, not an obligation. It's part of, comes with the order. It's been wonderful being with you today. I'll damn hedgehogs. Enjoy the day. Enjoy the rest of what the can amount to as an exceptional experience for you. I hope it's been useful to you today. I hope I've been able to provide you with some information and insights. If you are feeling that I'm trying to persuade you to look at our Grand Lodge in a different and respectful and honored light, well, I'm guilty of that. But I am a student of the history behind it. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. There you have it. Would that, if we took away the what would we call it, the strictness, the firmness of Grand Lodge and their clear expectations, would the assaults rekindle? Would the attacks on us rekindle? I would say in a New York minute. In a New York minute, we are that vulnerable. We don't need to be distracted by the shenanigans of people trying to put the attacks to us. May the great architect continue to provide the energy needed by our Grand Lodge to prevail. In the meantime, what can you and I do? We can show them respect and support. What we call Grand Lodge is an idea in our mind. Whatever symbols, whether it's a person, whatever acts, we can demonstrate our faith and our confidence and our trust in their judgment. But yeah, we should always hold them accountable. Yeah, we should make our decisions well-formed. We are, after all, though, a meritocracy. We avoid the anarchy that occurred within the democracy of Athens. Today, you and I living in a democracy, go crack your books and see the definition. We live in something else, a hybrid of some sort. I look forward to speaking with you, talking with you, joining you, and listening to your advice. If you have advice for me, my goodness, I certainly need it. I'll be around. See you soon. Thank you.